Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments today. First, in a couple of minutes, the lawyer and journalist Chase Madar will talk about over-policing and over-criminalization in the U.S. And then at the bottom of the hour, political scientist Jeff Smith will tell us about the political economy of Ferguson and its surroundings. Before that, a couple of words on our president, who seems to have checked out of governing. The other day, the New York Times reported that the Democratic leadership in Congress is exasperated by his reluctance to push for his own agenda. When Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid complained to Obama about Republican blockage of his ambassadorial nominees, Obama just told him to work it out with his Republican counterpart, Mitch McConnell. Almost from the first, Obama has shown little interest in working Congress or even the public, and now he seems more bored and disengaged than ever. And his limited and weak commentary on events in Ferguson, Missouri, delivered between rounds of golf on the Vineyard, has been disappointing even to someone like me who expected little from his presidency. People say he's reluctant to comment on racially charged issues because he doesn't want to draw attention to his own blackness. But wasn't part of the original selling point for Obama that having a black president would improve race relations in the U.S.? But if he's so inhibited from intervening in a racialized conflict because he's black, what has he gotten us but even more polarized and adrift? His apologists also say that he has little power to do much of anything. That claim is strange and confusing. He's the president. He has immense legal and discursive power. He could take a page from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who wrote an excellent analysis of Ferguson the other day, saying, among other things, that it's as much about class polarization as it is about race. That might change the way people think. But of course he doesn't want to talk about class, lest it offend Wall Street and the CEOs. Or he could have vigorously defended the right to protest without cops tear-gassing demonstrators and pointing automatic weapons at reporters. But he didn't. Clearly he's okay with the status quo and not particularly interested in ending police violence and promoting free expression. What a disaster. Okay, on to Chase Madar. We've been hearing a lot lately about the militarization of policing in the U.S. Much of that commentary has focused on the equipment, and rightly so, it's horrible. But the equipment is part of a broader strategy of criminalizing too much activity in the U.S. and policing too aggressively. Chase Madar, a civil rights lawyer and author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, wrote a piece for Tom's Dispatch last December on this topic that was just reprinted by the Bill Moyers website. Chase Madar. The militarization of the police has now become a mainstream concern. We've got Rand Paul even weighing in. What do you make of it?
It is a serious concern, and it's about time that people were talking about it, whether it's Senator Claire McCaskill or Senator Rand Paul and people across the board. You see this in Ferguson, Missouri, with the police wearing gear and having toys that our soldiers would be so lucky to have abroad.
I saw an eyewitness who said, you know, I was at the 82nd Airborne, and this is heavier than what we did in the war zone.
Yeah, a lot of people are saying that. And why do American towns and cities have MRAPs, these mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles? Why do they have these grenade launchers? Why do they have this military gear? And why are they wearing military fatigues and in semi-military formations? It's deeply troubling. You know who's the greatest American journalist to cover this is a guy named Radley Balco, writes a blog on the Washington Post now. He's a libertarian, but he is really king of the police overkill beat, especially when it comes to militarization.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, one is suspicious of libertarians sometimes, but on this issue, many of them seem, as we used to say in the party of the right, quite sound.
Absolutely. I think we all need to put some differences aside and join together left, right, center, and different, you know, ethnic groups to get together to beat this police overkill. And that requires cultivating virtues like forbearance, tolerance, and, you know, often disagreeing in theory, but agreeing in practice, which can be kind of interesting.
Now, you asked earlier why all this militarization. What's your answer?
Well, it's been creeping since the 60s. A lot of people like to say, oh, it's only since 9/11, or oh, it's only because there's this surplus gear from our invasion of Iraq. It's been going on a lot longer than that. You have SWAT teams developed in California in the mid-60s.
Deployed against the Black Panthers.
Black Panthers, and then later on against the Symbionese Liberation Army. But yeah, against the Black Panthers. And they weren't particularly successful then, but they made a big splash. It helped politicians puff out their chests and look tough to devote funding to this, to pose in front of the cameras with this. This is in a context of rising crime rates, too. I have to bring that up, where you do have the homicide rate in the United States double between 1960 and 1980, the rate of reported rape nearly quadruple in that time. So I'm not saying this was a solution. It wasn't. But in the context of rising fear of crime, somewhat rationally based, you have this crazy militarized response to it.
And politicians, of course, found that it worked well at the ballot box.
Oh, sure. You can smear your opponent with being soft on crime by not wanting to have these SWAT team units holding back, you know, coddling criminals by not sicking, heavy police no-knock raids on them. That's still a way to get votes in much of the country, unfortunately.
But the militarization is a very visible and scandalous and painful part of it. But there's a larger story here, isn't there?
That's right, Doug. The militarization of the American police is really only the spear tip of a larger phenomenon of over-criminalization and over-policing. And I don't say that to minimize how important militarization is. It is, and you can see this at Ferguson, and you've been seeing it elsewhere for the past 40 years. But underneath that, you have this growing trend of trying to solve all of our social problems and even some non-problems by throwing cops and prosecutors at them. Doing this even without SWAT teams, even without tear gas and no-knock raids, but trying to solve all of our problems with law enforcement. And this is the real story of why we have the world's highest incarceration rate. And this is the, you know, the bigger thing that's pushing us towards becoming a police state. And I use that word advisedly, I think, without hyperbole.
Yeah, we'll expand on that. What do you mean by police state?
We are trying to solve more and more of our problems by throwing cops and prosecutors at them. Just let me run down a list of examples. Disorder in public schools, even elementary schools, more and more, the answer is to throw cops at it, put police personnel in the schools. This would have been unthinkable a generation ago, a generation or two ago. All nations regulate in some way immigration and their borders. We have decided to do this over the course of the past 20 years, especially by using criminal law and criminal prosecutions. Did not used to be that way, even at high points of undocumented immigration to this country. Some sympathy for the white-collar devil. There's this mistaken faith that we can get a sound financial system and a sound economic system simply by using criminal law and busting people right and left. And what this leads to is not a better financial or economic system. It just leads to these very theatrical prosecutions of inside traitors and other such miscreants.
Parenthetically, this is kind of an obsession of mine. The obsession with insider trading is very interesting.
Yes.
It's basically just one rich person stealing from another rich person. And I guess the from the point of view of the elites is that it might discredit the market system. But as a crime, it's just so much went on during the mortgage bubble that has gone completely unpunished. Yet we go after some guys who get a tip on a trade.
Absolutely.
It's really hard to figure out who the victim of that sort of thing.
Who's the victim? And you know, as you point out, what led to the collapse of Wall Street a few years ago was many things, but it was not insider trading. Personally, I would say that about 98% of what led to the collapse of the asset bubble in Wall Street a few years ago was perfectly legal. And that's a grim truth that a lot of people, conservatives and liberals, don't want to swallow. It's rather comforting to believe that it were just some criminals who abused a good system and brought it all down. Actually, it's a systemic problem, and we need to get beyond catchy slogans like crime in the suites and prosecuting. We're not going to be able to prosecute our way to a just economy, to a fair economy. We need to be more ambitious, talk about restructuring.
Getting back to the school thing, I mean, we're now at the stage where we're seeing children handcuffed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is remarkable, and it's seen as typically American in a really bizarre way when you talk to people overseas. You have more and more schools, still a minority in this country, but more and more schools, particularly working class schools with non-white student bodies in big cities that have metal detectors, that have security outsourced to police personnel. New York is one of these cities.
The entrance of my kid's elementary school, there are two cops there.
Yeah.
Fortunately, not armed, but there's still two
cops.
Yeah,
and why is youth discipline in a school a police matter? This was personally my point of entry into over-policing. I was working at as a staff attorney at a community center in Bushwick, Brooklyn, working-class Spanish-speaking immigrant neighborhood predominantly. And, you know, people would come to me with these cases if they had been handcuffed in school. Some kids were just utterly harmless, too. You know,
What sort of offense?
They were walking in the halls late, or, you know, they got to school late, or, you know, they got in a very mild, you know, verbal altercation with another student.
That's school.
That's school, yeah.
As I remember school, that happened all the time.
Sure. And it's just bizarre. I mean, a shoving match, okay, outside a nightclub or on a city street at 2 a.m. on a Saturday night, okay, maybe a police officer should get involved. But in a schoolyard between 12-year-olds, why on earth would we make that a police matter? But that's the direction we're heading in. And in New York, you know, where I'm based, you even read every year or so about a teacher or a principal getting arrested along with the student when that figure of authority intervenes or tries to intervene, because they are really not in charge of many schools. And I want to make this very clear. I've co-authored some reports and some semi-academic articles. This is not the only viable way to get order and, you know, safety and a tranquil learning environment in schools. And I could take you to schools in the South Bronx, in Bushwick, in Harlem, where you have excellent school discipline and order, but without the metal detectors, without the security guards, and without cops banging people's heads and putting kids in plastic cuffs.
And then what happens after these kids get handcuffed? They're taken down to the precinct and central booking?
Frequently, they get taken down to the precinct. Frequently, it sort of becomes a punitive medical checkup where they get taken to a psych ward. Or they will just be handcuffed and kept in a room for a while, you know, a few hours at school. Mississippi really leads the way, you know. Those of us who are, you know, think of ourselves as enlightened, we like to imagine that Mississippi is the atavistic past of our country. But really, it's kind of the cutting edge and the vanguard where we're all heading in many ways, especially when it comes to policing schools. I mean, there you have kids getting handcuffed or wearing the wrong color belt for talking out of turn on a school bus. There was a great report about this that I mentioned, in fact, linked to in my article, The Criminalization of Everyday Life, that people can easily find online.
I'm speaking with Chase Mandar, who is a journalist and attorney and author of The Passion of, have you changed it to Chelsea, or is it still Bradley Manning?
I say Chelsea Manning, but the title still does read the old name, yeah.
Okay, so moving up from schools, then we get to grown-ups. What kinds of behaviors have been criminalized over the last decade or two that used to be little more than nuisances?
Well, let me talk about two areas. You have increasing criminalization of internet usage. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is a federal law that's incredibly vague, incredibly capacious. This was what was thrown at that young computer genius, Aaron Swartz, who was really driven to suicide by this harsh prosecution that was leveled at him. It's not really clear what this law is even trying to solve. It's far too vague and far too broad. You have over-policing of sex in the United States. I mean, all societies have tried to regulate prostitution in some way. Most societies have had some form of prostitution or sex work. But what we have done for so long is just this punitive approach that instead of alleviating whatever harms come out of it, only makes them worse. And it has terrible public health effects. You saw this in a recent public health study of Rhode Island, where sex work was inadvertently decriminalized. And there's a recent Lancet study looking at the adverse health effects of the criminalization or heightened criminalization of sex work in Sweden. So in the U.S., you have that. You also have this sick phenomenon of it's easier and easier for someone to get put on a sex offender registry where they're pretty much stuck for the rest of their lives. And I'm not just talking about, you know, child molesters or people doing absolutely horrible things, but public urination is an offense that can get you put on a sex offender registry in many states of our country. And even children as young as 11 who get busted for playing doctor or something like that. Something that might deserve punishment or discipline, but that can get that kid put on a sex offender registry for the rest of their lives.
But now, of course, then we also have poor urban neighborhoods, which are under constant pressure from the cops. Mm-hmm. And what's happening there?
You have this intensified over-policing that's the full fury of which is directed at working-class, urban, non-white, particularly black, above all, neighborhoods in the U.S., where even misdemeanor arrests can ruin people's lives and can result in jail time, can result in heavy fines, and the inability to pay those fines can lead to additional jail time as well as court processing fees. The social costs of this kind of broken windows policing are immense, and they can derail people's lives, even if it's for a very petty offense or a very minor offense. And you find people getting busted in working class, urban, non-white neighborhoods for all kinds of petty offenses that would not get any police response in a wealthy neighborhood. You know, walking a dog without a license. This is something that can get you a summons in some areas and will get you a summons in Bushwick, in East New York, in parts of the Bronx. It's not going to happen to you in Carroll Gardens or the Upper West Side or the nice precincts of the West Village.
Now, I believe you cite in your piece a study by a lawyer who found that any one of us could be committing 3 federal felonies a day.
That's right. So many of our laws, particularly federal laws, but not only, are so vague that really you might be violating one. For instance, if you get a circular or just a piece of junk mail in your mailbox and you don't deliver it to your neighbor, you know, and if it, say it's a government thing, even though it's just a circular, well, then you're committing a federal crime and you could be busted on that. And that's just the start of it. This really is corrosive to the social fabric. It shreds the social fabric. And it doesn't just stop once someone is put in jail or prison for a while, because the fury of this surveillance state, this over-policing state, will then go to their kids and their families. And children who have a parent in jail are much more susceptible to being pulled out of their family and stuck into foster care than kids who don't have a parent in jail. And once those kids are in foster care, if they are going to be under the watchful gaze of the police state themselves, so fisticuffs, which might happen between cousins or in a family situation, you know, as a matter of course. I mean, I had a younger brother. That would not wind, you know, me or anyone else in jail. But if you're in the child service system, then that can easily get you sent to juvenile hall.
And then the jails or prisons themselves, the discipline in those has been severely intensified.
Yeah, even our prisons are over-policed. That's how bad it is. And, you know, the ultimate form of punishment is solitary confinement. People may think it might sound like a restful break and protection from dangerous inmates, but it drives people crazy fairly quickly. It's a form of no-touch torture, and we have between 70 and 100,000 people locked up in long-term solitary confinement. And very often, especially in California prisons, this is a punishment not of the last resort, but a punishment almost of the first resort for inmates who wear what is perceived to be gang colors or who violate some prison rule.
Or subscribe to left-wing magazines.
Or subscribe to Left Business Observer, or read Tom Dispatch, where my article, The Criminalization of Everyday Life, first appeared. So you see, even there in America, we have this harsh over-policing. And it's, you know, over-policing and over-criminalization, it's of course not spread evenly throughout our society. What is? It's especially directed at working class people, at Black and Latino people, at immigrants, people with disabilities, you know, the out-groups that you would probably expect.
Now, I've heard people, even fairly liberal people, say, oh, that's all terrible, but we've had a great drop in crime in the United States over the last 20 or so years, and these tactics have been central to this decline in crime. What do you say to that?
Well, the evidence that this has been central to the decline of crime is simply not there. I mean, you could argue that it's a part of it, but you know, even if you believe in that a little bit, it's time for a peace dividend. I mean, it should be a mark of shame for all Americans that we are the world's leading incarcerator, that our incarceration rate is more than double, close to triple, the peak rate of the old East Germany, that our incarceration rate is fast approaching the rate of the Soviet Union at the peak of the Gulag. We need to find other ways to for social order. You know, all societies have norms, social norms, rules. And you know who are the most, you know, rule-abiding people of them all? Are anarchists. Go to an anarchist, you know, commune or you know, apartment squat, or hang out with the anarchists, as I'm sure you did at Occupy Wall Street. They have their rules and their protocols. The way that we enforce social norms should not be through violence and punishment. There are other ways to regulate and have a fair society, a free society, without just sicking the cops on everybody, the kids, you know, the older people, and we need to get beyond that.
So what are other ways of approaching these things?
If you look at, you know, Germany, for instance, a comparable society, you know, about 90 million people in the advanced industrial society, for prosecuting youth offenses, they will charge most people, even up to age 21, between 18 and 21, as youth, because they realize that young people are going to make some pretty stupid judgment calls. And they realize that by inflicting criminal punishment and branding even kids as criminals, that you are basically creating someone who has a much higher likelihood of recidivating, of committing crimes later and later. And that harsh approach, that harshly punitive approach, instead of restoring any kind of justice in the individual who was wounded by the crime or in the individual perpetrated, you are just perpetuating the violence.
In the last couple of years, we've seen a slight decline in the incarceration rate. It peaked a few years ago. Can't remember which exact year, but it did. And you hear more and more people, certainly not a majority yet, but you do hear more and more talk about rethinking this incarceration approach. Is there hope for turning this around?
People are starting to talk about it, but there's also, I think, a false sense of security that it's happening on its own. It isn't. And even talk about the federal level, where you had Cory Booker and Rand Paul co-sponsor a new bill that would, you know, have much milder justice for youth offenders. I mean, it's good that they're talking about that, but first of all, federal laws are a much smaller piece of this than many people know. Only 6% of the total prisoners in the United States are in the federal system. And it's much more important, has a bigger impact, what Texas or Florida or California does. And even there, you know, the momentum is still very often towards greater incarceration. It's true that New York, New Jersey, and a few other states have decarcerated a bit over the past few years. But even with that decarceration that's happened, we still have much higher rates of imprisonment than other countries. Let me put it to you this way, Doug. Even if the United States let out every single nonviolent drug offender from our jails and prisons, we would still have the world's highest incarceration rate.
You know, people have an idea that that drug crimes are responsible for most of the prison population. That's not true at all.
That's not true. I mean, it's certainly a big piece of it, but only 1/4 of the total number of prisoners in prisons and jails are in for nonviolent drug offenses. You know, some of the other offenses, the violent offenses, might have something and do have something to do with the drug trade. But it's not just a matter of letting out nonviolent drug offenders, no.
But our discourse around this, I mean, this has a lot to do with it. We talked about the war on crime, the war on drugs. We've been making war on these things for several decades now.
We have been, and war is really no longer a metaphor, as we've seen in Ferguson, and to, you know, bring this around. I mean, the militarization is complete. But it's not just the militarization. As I've been saying, it's the way that this criminal law paradigm and using punishment has just entered the DNA of our social policy across the board for how we try to get order in schools, how we try to get order in, you know, regulating our borders, how we regulate sex, and how we regulate drug use and even, you know, business and normal economic activity. And there are better ways to do it across the board than just this harsh approach, hitting everything as hard as we can with a hammer. This is turning us into a police state. It is not bringing us real freedom, real justice, or anything like that. We're not a free country when everyone or most people are afraid of the police.
And finally, where do you think this emerges from? Is it cynical politicians just manipulating public fears? Or does it serve some kind of rational purpose for the elite in the class structure?
That's a very complex question. I think it certainly does serve the interests of the 1% and the elites, where you have had economic security, such as it was, evaporate slowly and then quickly over the past 40 years. Much of the legitimate fears that families and individuals and households have about their insecurity gets kind of shunted off into crime insecurity. And that was easy for that to happen because you did have seriously rising crime rates and violent crime from 1960 up until the early 90s. That's something that very often liberals try to ignore or explain away, but, you know, it did happen. That's not to justify at all the response of locking everyone up and having this hypercarceration, this hyperpunitive state, but it does partially explain why people were amenable to this kind
of
incredible
harshness. But then the crime rate peaked 20 years ago, and we're still doing this.
We're still doing it, yeah. I mean, once you get these laws and these practices in place of locking people up, of, you know, extreme brute force from the police, they're very hard to undo.
I was Chase Madar, an attorney and writer. His book, The Passion of Bradley Manning, was published last year by Verso. The title was set before Manning became Chelsea. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Oh, some of the Clash doing Police on My Back. Next up, Jeff Smith. Smith, a professor of urban policy at the New School, is a former state senator from St. Louis. He had an op-ed in the New York Times the other day on why Ferguson is the way it is. A majority black city, almost entirely run by whites, with a police force that constantly harasses the population. With few sources of revenue, the city relies heavily on issuing traffic tickets, which institutionalizes the racialized harassment of the black population by white cops. Jeff Smith.
Welcome, Jeff Smith. First of all, just a word about your career history. It's not typical that an academic has a prehistory as a politician. How did you go from state senator to a professor?
Well, I took a little detour and I went to prison in between the two.
Well, that's quite some preparation. How'd that happen?
I was in the state senate in Missouri, and before I had been in the state senate, I had run for United States Congress. During that congressional campaign, my aides came to me. I was running in a 10-way congressional primary against a guy named Russ Carnahan, whose father had been a two-term governor and his mother had been a U.S. senator. I was in a crowded primary. We had a lot of momentum, and then about a month from Election Day, two of my aides came to me and said that someone had approached them asking if they had information about Carnahan's voting, his attendance record in the state legislature, which was thought to be abysmal. They gave him that information, and even though it was publicly available information, handing it to that man constituted a campaign finance violation, because the guy then sent a postcard with that information. When they told me about it, I told them I didn't want to know any details at all. And I signed an affidavit to that effect later when Carnahan filed a Federal Election Commission complaint. 5 years after that, when I was a state senator, my best friend wore a wire for a couple months and got me to admit that I had told my aides not to tell me anything, which consequently made the affidavit I had signed false. Then when I was approached by the feds, and the only way for me to probably stay out of prison would have been to wear a wire on others, and I didn't do that. So I spent about a year in federal prison.
Wow, this is an ironic compliment to the other segment on this show, which is about over-criminalization, because it seems like a case of that. And then you got out of prison and pursued an academic career?
Yeah, well, I had already earned a doctorate in political science. And so, you know, I had already taught as an adjunct before that while I was in the state senate. So now that I, you know, had to resign my office, I applied for academic positions and found interviewed for this position here at the new school. And I teach in a graduate program of public policy.
Bracketing the experience with the authorities, how did your public service affect the way you see the academic field of political science?
I mean, I think 90% of it is useless. Most of the research that comes out of political science has no bearing on the real world, and that's unfortunate. Of course, there are some great political scientists who are certainly very interested in real-world politics and political phenomena, but there's also a lot who write about politics and exhibit a real lack of understanding of the way things really work. It's really hard to quantify most legislative phenomena. Most of what happens in a legislature is based on relationships. And I think that academics haven't grasped the extent to which that's the case.
And it does seem like the field is almost trying to ape economics and becoming even more quantitative than ever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, definitely there are different ways in which quantitative analysis can offer, you know, improved leverage in trying to explain various phenomena, but there's a lot of places that it's a failure, and I think political science doesn't always grasp that.
Okay, now let's move on to Missouri. I'm sad to say, I think to most Americans, St. Louis does not have a very high profile. Certainly, you know, people don't think about it anywhere near as much as Detroit or other Midwestern medium-sized cities. How do you characterize the general St. Louis metropolitan area? How economically dynamic is it these days?
I'd say not very dynamic. You know, it's definitely hasn't plumbed the depths that Detroit has plumbed, but it's struggled. You know, we've lost a lot of major corporate headquarters over the last couple of decades, and lost the, you know, TWA, which was, you know, a big, St. Louis was the hub for TWA, and that hurt us a lot. American Airlines, when they bought TWA, they eventually moved, you know, a lot of their operations to other cities, and it's been really difficult to lose that, and as well as several of our largest banks and other firms have moved, and auto manufacturing, you know, it has been very choppy, obviously, over the last 20 years or so. So a lot of the industries that we relied upon, you know, because we were the second biggest car maker in the country to Detroit. And so a lot of these industries we've really relied upon have really gone south. And we haven't been able to take advantage of some emerging industries to the extent that we otherwise might have. We actually mapped the human genome before anyone else at Washington University in St. Louis about 15 years ago. But then the state legislature and a lot of various ballot initiatives threatened to ban embryonic stem cell research, and a lot of our top scientists moved to other cities. So there's been a lot of ways in which the political climate has affected the economics as well.
And then what about the broader political scene in Missouri? I mean, how would you characterize it? Is it sort of a Southern Republican, more complicated than that?
In some ways, it's a microcosm of the country. The country has two coasts that are blue, and then most of the heartland is red. And Missouri has two cities on either edge, the western edge, we have Kansas City, and the eastern edge, St. Louis, that are sort of blue islands in a red sea. So I would say it's, in some ways, a microcosm of the country. Much of the middle of Missouri used to be, kind of old school yellow dog Democratic, but kind of conservative Southern Democrats, as has been the case in much of the heartland. Those people have gradually become Republicans, and their children are definitely Republicans. So even if some of that older generation continue to vote Democratic, younger people in our rural counties are overwhelmingly Republican, and that has turned the state such that the state legislature is dominated by conservative Republicans.
And what of the governor, Jay Nixon, of whom we've been seeing a fair amount recently?
He's a sort of a moderate, probably slightly center-right Democrat. Law and order guy, was attorney general for 16 years, comes from a collar county of St. Louis called Jefferson County, which benefited from the exodus of whites out of St. Louis City as blacks began moving from North City to South City. His formula for political success in Missouri has always been to just be, you know, very much a law and order guy. And he's had some tense relationships with African Americans over the last, 25 years. And I think some of the unease that you've seen and uncertainty that we've seen from him is due to kind of a long history of sometimes tense relationships in the black community.
So he doesn't sound like a custom-made peacemaker for the current situation.
He's got a lot of credibility with the law enforcement community because of his time as attorney general. He doesn't have as much credibility in the black community. So he's maybe not the ideal peacemaker right now.
Okay, so now let's talk some about the political structure of the St. Louis area. It's very fragmented, right?
It's very fragmented. There's 90 municipalities in St. Louis County, and St. Louis City is a separate entity from St. Louis County. The city seceded from the county in 1876.
Why did the city secede?
It was sick of providing services to the outlying areas when people started moving outside a certain kind of bound. It was getting expensive, I guess, because obviously, horse and buggy, if there was a fire in an outlying area, whatever, to provide just sort of basic public services, they sort of drew a line around the urban core and said, we're not, everything outside of this is no longer in St. Louis.
Now, elsewhere, we saw cities taking the opposite tack and annexing their suburbs, right?
Correct.
But not St. Louis.
That's what you see in places like Phoenix, a lot of places in kind of Sun Belt cities have done exactly that. They've grown with the migration. St. Louis went in the opposite direction.
Now, Detroit, despite the desperate shape that the central city is in, has some very rich suburbs. Is something similar true of St. Louis?
Yes, absolutely. Ladue, Town and Country, Huntley, Country Life Acres. St. Louis has some of the wealthiest suburbs in the country.
I'm speaking with Jeff Smith, the former Missouri State Senator who now teaches urban policy at the New School in Manhattan.
But then there's Ferguson. So tell us how Ferguson got to be in its current situation.
Well, it used to be overwhelmingly white. In the 50s and 60s, was overwhelmingly white. It started to change in the 70s and 80s, and then it really started changing after 1990. In 1990, it was still three-quarters white and about a quarter black. Now, it's about almost exactly the mirror image of that, almost three quarters black and about a quarter white. Those changes have continued to accelerate, and I expect they'll accelerate even faster in the next couple of years. So it's a city that has had an institutional lag between the power structure versus the electorate, right? The city council, the school board, the other institutions that govern the community have not reflected the increasing diversity of Ferguson.
What happened in the 20 years to turn Ferguson from two-thirds white to two-thirds black?
You know, it's just the more black people came, the more white people left. And it just sort of fed on itself. And, you know, once the school district started to change, the school district became about, you know, majority black, then whites started moving out in droves. And now the school district is over 80% black. And my guess is that within a decade, it'll be almost 100% black. Actually, a lot of the white community up there, Catholic, a lot sent their kids to private schools. And, you know, there were very strong kind of community institutions there. But a lot of those white families moved to the next county west, which is called St. Charles County, or a few suburbs that are further west of Ferguson.
And what are the demographics of the remaining whites?
They're mostly middle class. You know, there's some that are sort of like working class that live in. Ferguson's not poor. The district that I represented, which was adjacent to Ferguson, about 5 minutes east of Ferguson, not directly adjacent, but 5 minutes east of there. Most of that part of my district was much poorer than Ferguson. That was North St. Louis City, from which many of Ferguson's blacks came. And Ferguson's white population is, you know, there's a lot of strong middle class, and there's even some affluent areas of Ferguson. There's one really nice area near the old downtown that's got, you know, turn-of-the-century mansions. So I would say that, you know, there's a divide even within Ferguson that, you know, the whitest areas of Ferguson, you know, are very affluent, and the poorest areas of Ferguson are overwhelmingly black.
And how does how do whites manage to dominate the city's power structure, the city council, the police?
There's a bunch of different ways. But first and foremost, the black population is much younger than the white population. Young people don't, you know, young people under 18 can't vote. People between 18 and 30 don't vote, but people over 60 do vote. So just a generational divide explains a lot of it. A second piece of it is the timing of elections. So they have elections at, you know, in the spring, municipal elections in the spring, and lower income people are much less likely to turn out. Third, you know, there's sort of a clique of white insiders that have tended to sort of control the machinery of power. They've helped, you know, helped a lot of their allies get municipal contracts, and a lot of their allies have rewarded them by supporting their campaigns. And, you know, it takes money to win an election. Even at the municipal level, it takes enough money, you know, to get yourself known across a town. And not many African Americans in Ferguson have been able to crack through that.
And so there are a lot of roots to this social explosion we've seen.
Yes, yes. And as I write about in the New York Times piece, the disconnect, the racial, you know, disconnect between the police force in Ferguson and the population, I'm sure has exacerbated that. I was, you know, most of my childhood friends and teammates on my basketball team growing in high school, they knew not to go into Ferguson. They always got pulled over there, and they avoided it at any cost. They, you know, Ferguson's had a reputation for this for a long time. It's over-reliance on traffic stop-generated revenue, which is almost a quarter of its annual budget, causes the, you know, pressures the police to make a lot of stops. And when you have this big racial divide between the police and the people being policed, you tend to have, you know, it's sort of a powder keg.
Yeah, that was kind of amazing. In your piece, you point out that several of these towns around St. Louis basically derive a lot of their income from traffic tickets. I mean, they're just financed by speed traps.
Yeah.
So, and there's no other tax base to speak of?
Not much. You know, a lot of the malls that used to be in North County are no longer there. or are decrepit and very few people go to them. So some of these communities are purely residential. Others have small, you know, a few small businesses, but not much that produces much revenue.
Now, did it surprise you to see what's happened in Ferguson over the last week or 10 days?
I mean, no, not really. You know, this is sort of, there's been simmering racial tension for a long time. It just took an incident like this, poorly handled and managed by the authorities to blow the lid off. But this is something I've seen for a long time. My district I represented was a majority black district, and you know, I heard a lot of the frustration for a long time.
But you know, there are many places like this around the country, I suppose, and this is just happened to be where it happened and when it happened.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
So what it can be done? I imagine. I mean, this is going to it will not be good for the economic future of Ferguson to see this kind of unrest.
It'll be terrible for Ferguson, and it'll be terrible for the St. Louis region. You know, as people decide where they're going to have conventions next year, not a lot of people right now are saying, you know, let's have it in St. Louis.
So is there a way out of this?
You know, one thing I proposed in the New York Times piece was municipal consolidation, having a lot of these suburbs get together, because that would help ameliorate the strain on their budgets that pressures them to do all these traffic stops. And as long as you have these, you know, this disconnect between the race of the people doing the policing and the people who are living in these communities, you're going to continue probably increasing the racial hostility, interracial hostility. So consolidation, which would make it so that every one of these 90 municipalities doesn't have to have its own police force. You know, they don't all have them, but most have their own police force. And, you know, fire trucks, other expensive parts of the public safety apparatus, that really, you know, makes it a lot harder to, you know, for these towns to be financially stable. And it would help them merging, you know, with a lot of other municipalities would reduce the fragmentation. It would probably make it harder for some of these small sort of cliques and cabals to run these little towns and exclude certain people, you know, certain groups from power. So on a lot of levels, I think that's probably a good long-term political solution.
But of course, the vested interests would not be interested in this approach.
No one ever wants to give up power.
So you basically have these like little parasitical classes in each town that kind of run things to their own benefit and self-perpetuating, and there's really no incentive for them to change the way they do business.
I'd say that's mostly accurate. Yeah, the state legislature would probably have to step in and legislate a merger of these municipalities.
And what would the likelihood of that be?
Pretty low, probably.
And St. Louis itself, I mean, there's real no. If there's no dynamism at the urban core, is there really
There's some dynamism. You know, there's a lot of young people that move back downtown in the same way that they have in cities across the country, but there's just not enough.
So, I mean, that sounds like the fundamental problem of the region is there's just nothing driving prosperity there.
Yeah, I would agree. That's a fundamental problem.
And do you see any way out of that situation?
There are definitely people that are working on trying to boost entrepreneurialism in the city. There's a good friend of mine who's, you know, seeded this program called Arch Grants to try to bring entrepreneurs from all over the country to St. Louis based on the low cost of living and the intellectual capital we have, partially from Washington University and other institutions. But those efforts are pretty embryonic, and, you know, I sure hope they bear fruit, but we'll see.
And that sort of thing really couldn't flourish without some support from the government, and it doesn't sound like the state or government would be very amenable to that.
Well, you know, the state's doing some small things in that area, but it's unlikely that it'll be enough to really jumpstart, you know, a movement. We're not going to be the next Silicon Valley. We'd love to, you know, to just have a little piece of that kind of mentality and entrepreneurship, but, you know, in Silicon Valley, you're nobody until you failed, you know, right? Everyone, like, you know, tries two companies and they don't work out, and then, like, the third one does, and that's sort of a badge of honor. The ones that have, you know, didn't work out, everyone goes through it. People try things, but St. Louis sort of has a different mentality. They don't look as kindly upon that sort of thing, so people probably aren't as people are a little more risk averse than most places, and that probably inhibits the real growth of entrepreneurial culture.
And finally, do you think the state government and the governor are up to the task of bringing peace and understanding to Ferguson, or is this beyond their capability?
It looks right now to be near beyond their capability. We'll see if there's a charge, and we'll see what a trial looks like. But until there's a charge made, I think there's going to be protests every night. If this guy doesn't get charged by the county prosecutor, I shudder to think what will happen, but I think the feds will step in and probably, the feds can't make a murder charge stick because they don't have jurisdiction, but they could do like a deprivation of civil rights charge, and that's probably, I think, the best chance of getting any, not having seen all the evidence. My gut is that such a charge is probably the best route to getting any prosecution, which is probably the only thing that will bring lasting peace to this community. And even that won't necessarily bring lasting peace because a lot of the forces, the structural forces I described, won't go away.
That was Jeff Smith, a former Missouri State Senator who now teaches urban policy at the New School. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Nick Lowe doing What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. Till next week, bye.
As I walk this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity, oh yeah, I ask myself, is all hope gone? Is there only pain? And misery. And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I wanna know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?